Welcome to Out in the Bay, queer radio from San Francisco. I'm Eric Jansen. Today, we have the pleasure of meeting the first ever openly gay California Supreme Court Justice. Associate Justice Martin Jenkins has been on the bench since last December. Besides being the first openly LGBTQ California Supreme Court Justice, he's also only the third black man ever to serve on our state's high court. And he's the only black man now. There is an African-American woman on the bench with him. He came out as gay fairly late in life, in his late 50s. He grew up in San Francisco, the son of a nurse and a janitor. He was a pro football player after college, before being convinced he'd be a great lawyer. He prosecuted police misconduct and KKK cross-burning cases, among others, for the U.S. Justice Department, and later became a judge for many courts. Now he caps that career by serving on California's highest court. Justice Jenkins has led quite a life. He's here to share some highlights with us and what he's learned along the way. Justice Martin Jenkins, thanks for being here on Out in the Bay.
Well, thank you, Mr. Jansen. It's okay to call you Eric.
Please do.
And it's okay if you call me Martin.
Fantastic. So to start off our conversation, I want us all to hear these inspiring and heartfelt words from your acceptance speech.
I want to say something about being a first. There have been firsts and there will continue to be first. There's a significant responsibility that goes with being first that I think can be best dispatched in doing the work at the highest level I possibly can. But I want to say to some young person who may be out there today, who is struggling with their identity, anyone who knows me knows my identity has been, as a gay man, perhaps the greatest challenge of my life. And it has not been easy. But I want to say today to those young people who may be watching and those who may hear about what has transpired here, that I am not here in spite of the struggle. I'm here because of the struggle. It has deepened my character, afforded me sensibilities about the world and about people who are not so willing to accept that people can love differently than they do, but nevertheless love sincerely and genuinely and effectively. I want these young people to know that living a life of authenticity is the greatest gift you can give yourself. And if you do that, you too will find yourself in a position where people see you. They really see you and who you are, your authentic self.
That's California Supreme Court Associate Justice Martin Jenkins accepting Governor Gavin Newsom's nomination in October 2020. So in your speech, you said that accepting your identity as a gay man was the greatest challenge of your life. What made it such a challenge in your particular situation?
Oh, I think a number of things, some external, some internal. I think some of the external hurdles that I needed to deal with was one in the community in which I was raised, a predominantly African-American community. You know, being gay was not a thing. You got those messages sometimes overtly, sometimes subtly. And I knew I was different. I'm not sure when I was very young that I could have described the difference, but I knew I was different. But I also knew that difference was not something that I should be robustly advertising, that it was better to keep that a secret. I was raised as a Catholic, baptized at birth. And so the Catholic Church's teachings on homosexuality were quite clear that it was a sin. I really believed I was a devout Catholic. I believed in church's teachings. I still do. And so though that was another external force that impacted my ability to come to a place where I could reconcile who I was as a gay person with, you know, my community expectations and my faith. And then, of course, you know, there are some of the internal considerations, the self-esteem issues that are impactful when you know you're different and the difference gets quantified in an emotional way that makes you feel less than confident, less than. So all of those things militated against me accepting myself. And that's why I say it's the greatest challenge of my life.
Can you tell us a little bit about the neighborhood you grew up in at that time? You grew up in the Ingleside neighborhood of San Francisco. And so this is the 50s and 60s. What was it like?
I like to say in a lot of ways, it was like living in the city, but in the suburbs, on the southern boundary of the city of San Francisco, out near San Francisco State College and Daly City. When I was a very young boy, the neighborhood was quite mixed. Some Chinese, Japanese, Caucasian, African-American, not many Latinos, Latinx individuals, but it was quite mixed. And by the time I was 11, 12, or 13, it became predominantly Black. San Francisco State College was a stone's throw away from our house. And so we would spend a lot of time there down in the football fields and playing basketball down there. The community was populated by mostly two-parent families with multiple children. And most of the individuals, the parents there, were blue-collar folks like my father, who was a janitor at Quay Tower. But there was a real family, a familial atmosphere, the ocean view, Merced Heights, Ingleside Community Center, I think helped out a lot of families there. There was a real esprit de corps there, and it was a great place, really, to grow up. You know, you hear this phrase, it takes a village to raise a child. Well, we had a village, no doubt about that.
You also said in your acceptance speech that you specifically address young people, telling them that living authentically is the greatest gift you can give yourself. And you also said that you're here, you've made this great achievement to be on the California Supreme Court because of your struggle, not in spite of it. What do you mean by that?
Well, struggle brings you to grips with the reality of who you are in your situation. The lack of struggle, I think, does just the opposite. The lack of struggle allows us to insert or believe things about ourselves that may not be, you know, sort of anchored in reality, our reality. And I just think it's always important to deal with what our reality is and who we are, because then you're on the glide path to acceptance and also getting the support and help you need to learn to accept who you are. And then when you can show up as who you are authentically, that's a power beyond measure that you have, that you've harnessed, because then your standards for who you are the ones that prevail, are the ones that allow you to walk forward and go forward and take on new challenges, as opposed to being controlled by what others think.
So what finally inspired you to come out to live your true self?
Oh, there were a couple of things. One, I had a good friend who was a judge, just the most incredible man, who died of stomach cancer at 49, very young. And he was gay. And I knew that, but we became friends and became very good friends. And I still wasn't dealing with who I was. I had not told him, but he knew. And then eventually I did tell him. And as he declined from the stomach cancer, about 2 weeks before he died, he invited me over to his house, he and his partner, and they had a birthday party for me. He was very low sick, but the kind of man he was, he's thinking about me, and he wants to celebrate my birthday. In the course of that birthday party, just a few people there, he grew tired, and we took him down to his bedroom, and barely talk, a whisper, but he asked me to come close to the bed, and he told me he loved me, how much he admired, respected me. I was a judge by then on the federal bench. And he also said that if he had one wish for me, it would be that I began to live my life as who I truly was.
And so that's when you made a change.
Oh, it started hugely then. In that moment, while he's dying, he's thinking about me and my life and what would make my life better. And that was difficult to throw that off, to dismiss it, to sort of go back to a place of fear. When this great man, who I respected and admired so much, cared that deeply about me.
And it's his dying wish, so you better follow through.
So that started, and some therapy, always a good thing, I think. If you can find someone who's really good, and I found an excellent therapist to try to walk through and unravel some of the tape recordings that I had made over time so that I could reprogram some of that, and walk through my faith and some of the issues that I had. And then I, through that therapy, I was able to tell my father. My mom had already passed, but I told my father one Sunday, and I told him after much consternation that I had something to tell him, and wasn't sure I was going to feel about it. I told him that I was gay, and he looked at me with a look that can only come from someone who grew up in the rural South outside of Houston, Texas, in farm cotton. He looked at me, and it was clear to me he didn't understand what gay meant. So I said, well, I think, Dad, in your day, they called it homosexuality. To which he then looked at me and walked across to where I was and put his face right in front of mine and said, how long have you known this? And I said, well, I had some of these feelings since high school, but I just didn't deal with them, didn't think who I was. And he said, well, I wish you'd have told me then. This could not have been easy for you. I love you, you're my son. There's nothing you could do that would ever make me stop loving you. And just gave me the biggest hug. And so those two things, that deathbed wish and my father's love, those two things really galvanized me in a way that empowered me. It gave me something to retreat to when I wanted to retreat myself.
Can you tell us a little bit about your career as a civil rights prosecutor? Basically, what were you doing for the U.S. Justice Department in prosecuting?
Well, I was doing two things. My parents were from the Jim Crow South, my mother from Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and my father from a little town called Brookshire, Texas, right outside of Houston. And they talked about their experience with Jim Crow and some of the discrimination that they experienced. But I grew up in San Francisco, and I didn't have the kind of experience that they had. But I think it primed me growing up in that home to respect people that are different, to want to do something to give back to community, to promote inclusion and equality. And the Department of Justice job was a job that in the legal context allowed me to do that. So the charge of the Civil Rights Division, and in particular the criminal section in which I worked, was to prosecute individuals who deprived people of their constitutional rights based on race or ethnic origin, religion. And so the sort of paradigmic case that section tried was the Rodney King case. That case was brought by the section I worked in a couple years after I left. And you investigated these cases across the United States. So if there was a police excessive use of force or killing someplace in Montana, we would fly out from Washington, D.C., do a little preliminary investigation and panel a grand jury, investigate the case. And if there was a liability there, then ask the grand jury to return an indictment. So as a young 26-year-old, I'm flying across the country having my own real-time experience in the Deep South and other places, not the same way that my parents had, but also dealing with some of the issues that they had complained of, that they were subject to. And so I was doing that, but I was growing as a person. Now, I never took a job without asking myself, what are the skills that I can develop as a lawyer? And how will this position cause me to grow as a person?
That must have been quite an eye-opener.
It was.
We spoke a little bit on the phone last week. And when we spoke, you said that sometimes being Black and gay can bear on a case, and sometimes it doesn't. I may not have remembered your words exactly right, but you gave the example of Thurgood Marshall, the first African-American U.S. Supreme Court justice who served on our nation's highest court from 1967 through 1991. What did he say, or what did you learn from Thurgood Marshall's actions?
You know, saying that being Black and gay bears on the case, I think if you unpack that, I think what I was trying to say is that we are who we are. We tell jurors all the time when we pick juries that we're asking them to decide the case fairly objectively without bias. But bias is the price we pay, good and bad, but it's the price we pay for being human. We have interaction. We develop perceptions of people and attitudes towards things. And you don't; those things don't get erased because you walk into a courtroom or you become a judge. They are still with you. So I am a Black gay man all day, every day. And the experience that informs being Black and being gay is with me. The question is to not allow those things as best you can, superimpose themselves in a way that tilts a decision solely based on either of those two statuses, of being gay or being Black. So we have to account for them. We have to keep it out in front. Justice O'Connor wrote was part of a law review article that I think was done in the Harvard Civil Liberties Law Review many years ago. And it was all about the life and times of Justice Marshall. And one of the things that she commented on was his ability on the United States Supreme Court. He had many sterling abilities, but sometimes in a difficult case, in a voting rights case or an excessive use of force case, his experience as a Black man working on those cases, traveling in the Deep South, brought a certain reality tone to the legal issues they were grappling with, difficult issues, put a face on them, made them real about the impact of the law and how that impact, from a policy perspective, should be considered in fashioning the law. And that's what I was trying to get at. There are times in cases, a tax case or what have you, being Black and gay has nothing to do with it. But there are other times when life experience, properly accounted for, can illuminate the fabric of the law as it's being discussed and bandied back and forth. Because the law is about people and for people.
And it's about educating the other, your fellow jurors, jurists.
Right. And because we don't all walk in each other's shoes, that kind of cross-pollinization, that kind of education about the impacts of what we're deciding, I think is crucial. And that's why it's important to have different voices on a collective body like a court.
You're hearing Out in the Bay, Queer Radio from San Francisco. I'm Eric Jansen. My guest is Martin Jenkins, Associate Justice of the Supreme Court of California. He's the first openly LGBTQ justice on the state's high court. So can we talk about football for a couple minutes?
For a couple.
I know it's in your past, but it's one of those intriguing things. You know, it's also part of, it seems in a way, to me at least, part of your coming out story or not coming out story, perhaps. This is back in 1977 after you graduated from Santa Clara University, where you had also played football and tennis, but you were on the Seattle Seahawks. And the NFL especially has a reputation and image as being a macho, rough guy kind of place. But you may have a different perception of it, having been on the inside. What was your experience like there?
Well, first and foremost, it wasn't very long. Santa Clara is a Division II football program, a good Division II football program. And I was what people call a late bloomer. By the time I was a senior, there was some interest in me from the NFL. And I signed as a free agent, which means I wasn't drafted, with the Seattle Seahawks. And was there for a preseason game or two and got to come home and play a preseason game against the 49ers. At that juncture, I decided that, you know, I'd seen much of what there was to see, and I would have been a bubble player, what it's called, if I had made the team every year, sort of fighting for a position on the roster. And I'd already been admitted to law school, and it just made sense to me to come back and attend law school had gotten in at USF, and that's what I did. In terms of my experience, I didn't meet anyone who was out gay, not even anyone I was suspicious of on the Seahawks, I think primarily because I had suppressed those feelings to such a depth that my antenna wasn't up. And obviously for me, even consciously or unconsciously, sort of not wanting to deal with being gay or anything related to it was where I was at. So I didn't see anything that would evidence that there was someone there who was gay, but we know the population statistics are such that there probably were. The young man who just came out of the Oakland Raiders, first open gay man on active roster, it's hard to believe that that he's the first, you know, in the league. And I suspect that, that's not true. And many have come out after they finished playing. And I suspect the machismo piece of it in the NFL is a reason that sort of retards individuals' ability to walk in their truth. But it's not just the NFL. There are many, many institutions in our society that do the very same thing. Sometimes corporate America, we're seeing some loosening of that, but you don't find many CEOs and haven't who are openly gay, whether lesbian or gay, for some of the same reasons. Some of the boards have come along begrudgingly in terms of having someone at the top of the totem pole who's different.
Are there any cases coming up before the California Supreme Court in this coming year, in the near future, that are going to affect LGBTQ people that you know of?
Yeah, and I just couldn't answer that question. One, because our deliberations about the cases that we take are just that, they're confidential. But two, there's a website, the California Supreme Court website, and I invite people, one, because their tax dollars pay our salaries and they pay for the courts, to go on that website and to look, and there's a link that will describe the cases that the court has agreed to hear. And we now have our oral arguments on Zoom. And when the cases are scheduled, people can read a synopsis about what the case is and then watch in real time this branch, the third branch of government, and how it does its work.
Now, I know you told me you can't talk about any cases, but I do want to point out to our listeners that it did matter to Governor Gavin Newsom that you're gay, and that's one of the reasons he appointed you to the court. And I guess he was looking for someone gay to be on the court for a while, or someone LGBTQ, I should say. But I want to play this clip from what he said when he nominated you.
Judge Martin Jenkins has the right experience at the right time in our state's history. He'll also be making history as only the third Black man to serve on our highest court and the first openly gay Supreme Court justice. And trust me, as someone who understands firsthand the role of the court in determining marriage equality to be a fundamental right, I can't tell you how important it is to have someone on the bench who's a living, breathing example of the idea that love means love. He hasn't just learned the power of the law to protect our human rights. Martin Jenkins has lived it.
That's Governor Gavin Newsom in his nomination of Justice Jenkins, my guest, to be on the Supreme Court last October. So you've moved to Southern California recently after being a San Francisco Bay Area native for all this time. And I know, you know, as I grew up in Berkeley, you know, so just across the Bay, and we have this love-hate relationship with Southern California. Maybe it's probably more of a hate thing, honestly. It's the tradition. So, but you know, you just got this job on this California State Supreme Court, which is based in San Francisco, and now you moved to LA. So
yeah.
What tell us about that.
Well, that's all about falling in love. That's what that's about. You know, when you walk authentically, when you can become who you are, then you attract who you are and the kind of value set that you have. And I met my partner, Sidney Shand, about just after I started working for the governor in 2019. And he's just the most amazing person. He's a kind, generous, very smart, highly ethical, funny, compassionate man, and we fell in love and decided that he's a realtor here in Los Angeles, decided that I could do my work for the governor from anywhere in the state. We were going to move together. And as I said to him, why move away from your practice? I can move down there. We put in an offer in a house, and we're in contract when the governor apprised me that he wanted to nominate me to the California Supreme Court. And so that was already in the works. I will say this, growing up and being born and raised in San Francisco and spending most of my life there, the time I worked in Washington, D.C., and the time I was in Seattle, it's probably the best evidence of my ability to be fair and impartial that I could move to L.A. and embrace Angelenos near and far, because that's not something Northern Californians do so well. But I have not embraced the Dodgers.
Okay, well, thank you. And Los Angelinos listening, we love you too. Just want to make that for the record. I spent some time down there. So you're now about 9 months into this new gig.
Doesn't feel like 9 months.
Does it feel faster or more like 9 years?
Oh my God, it feels faster. It's long days. I mean, I think I get to work here about 7:30, and I usually leave about 7:30, 8 o'clock, and work most weekends as well, at least Saturdays. And my colleagues are doing the very same thing. I'm not sure that people really understand how hard judges work, because when we come out in the courtroom, you've done all the back study and work in your chambers. And so it looks efficient and well-prepared, and it is, but there's a whole lot of work that's done behind the scene. So long days, and I'm learning a new job, although I think I'm the second eldest justice on this court, and I've been around a lot. But you know yourself, every time you embark on something new, there's a transition and a learning curve. And so I'm going through that now as well.
So the last thing I want to ask you about is your community service. You've done a lot over the years. You worked for many years with a youth group at St. Patrick's Church in Oakland. You helped start Vincent Academy, a kindergarten through five charter school in West Oakland. And you've served as a mentor with San Francisco Achievers, which provides college scholarships and mentors Black male high school students. Are you still doing that even though you're in LA, or will you be doing that in LA in a different context with different groups?
Well, I am not still involved on the day-to-day aspects of what you just described, because I live down here now, but I was given so much. People have been incredibly good to me, incredibly good. Even my decision to go to law school was primed by my head football coach at Santa Clara, a white Irish man who was also raised in San Francisco, who saw something in me, leadership potential, and I was a good student. And encouraged me to go to law school, and invited several African-American law students at Santa Clara to come talk to me about why they decided to go to law school. Those are the kinds of things that have happened over the length and breadth of my life. And so I realize how that kind of support can change the trajectory of someone's life. And it has been my life desire and commitment to do that for others who follow. And so I will be doing some of the very same things here in Los Angeles once I get my footing.
Fantastic. Well, thank you very much. Martin Jenkins, I want to thank you for spending time here with us on the Bay and telling us about your experiences. And I've really enjoyed talking with you.
I have too, Eric. I've enjoyed talking with you, and keep doing the good work that you're doing as well.
That's Martin Jenkins, Associate Justice of the Supreme Court of California, the first openly LGBTQ justice on the state's high court. You've been listening to Out in the Bay, Queer Radio from San Francisco. To share this show with friends or hear it again and hear past shows, just go to our website, outinthebay.org. That's outinthebay.org. You can also sign up there for our occasional email newsletter so you won't miss an episode. And subscribe to Out in the Bay podcasts. You might also make a donation there to help us keep bringing Queer Air to your ears. We are an independent production. That means we receive no funds from the radio stations that air Out in the Bay weekly, nor from podcast platforms. Your gift will help keep LGBTQ voices and stories coming to you and to others who might not be able to give. Just hit the donate tab on our website, outinthebay.org. That's outinthebay.org. Thank you. And thanks to especially generous donors Richard Merck and Brad Payton of Silicon Valley and Cornelia Enders of San Francisco. Thanks also to our radio partners KALW 91.7 FM, SF Bay Area, and San Francisco Public Press and its radio station, KSFP 102.5 FM, for airing Out in the Bay weekly. And to WORT in Madison, Wisconsin, which now airs Out in the Bay monthly. Our theme music was written and performed by Holly Mead. This week's show was edited by Lucen Mendel. Please send us your comments. We'd love to hear from you. outinthebaysf@gmail.com. Really? Are you out there? Please let us know what you think, where you are, and how you're hearing us. That's outinthebaysf@gmail.com. I'm Eric Jansen. Thank you for listening, and thanks for joining us out in the Bay.